Coming up on Tech News Weekly, what happened to Civil? What happened to Huawei's CFO? What happened to using a polygraph? What happened to Tesla coils? And what happened to that package on my porch? All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 60, recorded Thursday, December 6th, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Brex, the first corporate credit card for startups. Get the card free, and TWiT listeners get Brex card fees waived in perpetuity at brex.com/TWiT.
And by Command Line Heroes, a podcast from Red Hat. Listen to the epic true tales of the developers, the programmers, the hackers, geeks, and open source rebels revolutionizing the technology landscape. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit redhat.com/heroes today.
And by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again when you can have brilliant, hyper-fast, super simple Wi-Fi with Eero. And now get total network protection with Eero Plus. Visit Eero.com/TWiT and get $100 off the Eero base unit, two beacons package, and 1 year of Eero Plus when you enter the code TWIT at checkout.
Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where every week we talk to the people making and breaking the latest tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. We have not one, not two, but five interviews this week.
We do.
We never have one or two, by the way.
Unless something happens and someone decides at the last minute that they don't want to experience our tough questions.
Yes, exactly. Be put through the ringer. We won't do that.
No, we never do that. Earlier this year, we spoke to podcaster Manush Zomorodi about her involvement in Civil. That was a plan to support journalism through the blockchain. We haven't heard a lot about Civil since then, and what we have heard is not so great, especially for journalists. Joining us to discuss how Civil hyped crypto returns but maybe didn't deliver is Lee Quinn, writer for CoinDesk. Welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me today.
So first, explain a little bit, remind people, how was Civil supposed to work?
Yeah, so Civil was supposed to launch a blockchain-powered platform for publishing where a lot of different newsrooms would be able to publish and accept tokens. They could accept them from readers and also from just contributors who wanted to, say, fact-check or in other ways contribute to the reporting process. They could get paid or they could contribute to, I guess, anything that the newsroom would need.
And so according to your sources, what were the journalists told versus the reality that they experienced?
So in meetings and in unofficial documents, the journalists were told that the token Civil, which has not yet launched, would be worth an estimated 75 cents and that it could go up as high as a few dollars, maybe even a dollar or $4. So far, the token has not been launched. And in some of the tax documents that they received as employees, again, they're not directly employed by Civil, but their newsrooms are sponsored by Civil. In those tax documents, actually, this token was valued at a fraction of a penny. So it's a really big difference between 75 cents and a fraction of a penny.
Well, and they launched this this token sale and then announced in October that it did not succeed. Sounded like they were very disappointed. You know, obviously they would be disappointed about that. It didn't go the way that Civil had planned. Why did it not go that way? Was it too complicated? Are we still kind of so early on in like thinking of tokens in this way that that people don't quite understand them? Or what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think there's not very many people who understand how to use tokens. There was a test involved in getting the tokens, which required people to say that they understood how to store them, how to spend them. And while that was very admirable on the part of Civil, trying to make sure that people that purchased them were doing it with some knowledge, there's not a lot of readers out there that actually have that knowledge. And even if we think about something like the New York Times and the subscriptions of the New York Times, New York Times subscriptions are maybe less than 1% of their total readership. So the idea of expecting people to pay for content online and then not only pay for it, but to go jump through all these hoops and pay for it through cryptocurrency is ambitious at best.
Well, we talked about the test before on the show, and it was asked questions like, you know, what's the difference between a hot and cold wallet, which, you know, we had to look up. And they did that in order to, like you said, to ward off speculation. But then it sounded like some of the people, some of the journalists were told differently, that they, that there was going to be like, the, you know, this was going to be a big return, that this was sort of like, you know, get ready, you're going to be able to, you know, be rolling in a bed of cash or something like that.
I mean, definitely there is evidence to suggest that the civil team spoke differently in meetings and in informal documents about the value of the token than they did in contracts and official documents. They were definitely giving the impression that the token would increase in value. However, I will say that there are many reporters who understood that risk, and definitely those promises were met with skepticism. It's not as if all the reporters in these newsrooms took for granted that they were going to be rolling in dough and suddenly very rich.
What about, kind of going down this like misunderstanding path around cryptocurrency as it is right now? Do you think there's any harm that might come? Like, obviously this is disconnected from, say, Bitcoin, and Bitcoin's market performance right now is not very good. They're different things, but maybe there's a perception that it's all the same and it's all connected. And if Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are tanking, people like look at it from a surface level and go, whoa, wait a minute. Anything that has anything to do with, cryptocurrency, now's a bad time. So we're not going to go there. Do you think there was any kind of crosstalk there?
I think definitely. And I actually even want to push back a little bit on the idea that Bitcoin is not doing well. Bitcoin is doing great if you consider what it was worth, at least on the open markets, 2 years ago.
That's
so, yes,
yeah,
last year when Civil decided to create a token, there was really inflated market prices, and those prices have since dropped. And a lot of people do associate that price drop with a crash as opposed to thinking about it in the long term. And yes, that definitely made some people very skeptical. And it led to some people who are less educated maybe about how to handle volatile financial markets making choices they might regret, which I think definitely played into the reason that Civil didn't work out, at least so far, in terms of its token.
Yeah.
So you write in your piece that Civil didn't really do anything wrong according to the SEC. Everything was in order. But did these journalists did they put money in to lose money, or are they sort of just right back where they started from?
So I want to clarify that I'm not a lawyer or a judge. I don't have any insight about what the SEC believes about this token. However, I will say that journalists did not pay money for this token. They worked believing that the token would be part of their compensation. So they were working basically for what right now is not for free, because they did also receive fiat payments, but for reduced rates compared to what they would have otherwise asked for if they had understood that that token would be a long time coming and may not be worth what they were originally promised.
Interesting. So the initial token sale didn't happen. And I think I read that they have plans for another sale. Do you happen to have any information as far as when that might happen? And I imagine some of these journalists, you know, they're going to stay with it. I'm sure some others, you know, that put money into the token sale would be getting it back. How is that all working behind the scenes?
So at least as far as I've heard, there's no plans for another token sale. There are plans for distribution, freely giving away. And I don't think even the Civil team knows exactly when it is they plan to do that yet. So none of the reporters that I heard of put money into the sale. They expected money from, they were working with the understanding that they would be compensated with these tokens. They were betting on that money coming in. Kind of like when you're freelancing and you're waiting for that check to come in. Mm-hmm. But this time the check never came. So in terms of the token sale that did fail, they paid back the biggest investor who contributed to the sale. So that's Joe Lubin, the founder of Consensus, who gave basically like $1 million to the sale, and he was promptly reimbursed. So in terms of the SEC, they see it as all the investors who tried to participate in the sale were reimbursed, but the people who expected that money to come in and did not maybe put in money but are waiting for it still, last I heard, have no idea when they're going to be receiving that compensation.
Hmm. And then the idea behind Civil, which is that people would support journalism, they would support like accurate journalism and somehow fight against fake news, that has not been reached either.
There's no publishing platform yet that's necessarily unique in terms of its technical capabilities. And kind of what I was talking about earlier about readers or contributors being able to receive tokens or pay tokens, it's not really clear what that would look like. And definitely each newsroom would be able to define its own models. But if we think about like the broader media ecosystem and what it is that people do in terms of getting micropayments or getting contributions from readers, there's not really a precedent for paying readers to do work for you and how you would verify and qualify that work and how you would price certain things. So, I mean, they say that there is a platform coming, but I don't really understand how the newsrooms would be using it or what it would add in terms of value to the process.
And so we also heard that Consensus, the parent company, as you described them, they have there's been rumors or that there was a lot of layoffs with them. And do you know how that fits in this bigger story?
Yeah. So Consensus, which is the parent company of Civil, announced today that they will be laying off 13% of their employees. I have no idea whether or not that impacts Civil yet or not. I don't even think the team at Civil knows entirely how that will impact them. But definitely, we've seen that the token craze of 2017 is dying down, and we've understood that there were some mistakes made there, and there will be repercussions in the form of not having a second chance for some of the people who participated. And for those who do survive, I'm sure that they're going to really be reconsidering about how they want to approach token distribution and promotion in the future.
Lee Quinn is a writer at CoinDesk. You can read all of her reporting there. She also writes for Teen Vogue and has previously worked at Newsweek, Mike, and more. And check her out at CoinDesk.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Yes, thank you. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon. The elusive story of the arrest of Huawei's CFO in Canada. That's up next. News coming out today, and we've got some information on that with Mark Gurman. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Brex, which is the first corporate credit card for startups with a 5-minute online application and underwriting based on cash in your bank account. Brex can actually offer your company 10 to 20 times higher limits than other corporate credit cards with no personal liability required. So you can enjoy high value rewards specifically tailored to modern businesses, high multipliers on services that you spend the most on. And that includes 7 times on rideshare, 3 times on restaurants and travel, 2 times on all that software that you purchase. There's no limit on how many points you can earn, and points can be redeemed for statement credit on transactions. Also, exclusive offers with some of the best technology brands and services like AWS, Google, Salesforce, WeWork, and others. Brex underwrites your company and not you, so there's no minimum operating history, painful paper application, or personal liability required. Brex uses the cash raised by your business and then extends credit, doesn't require a credit score, doesn't require a social security number or a security deposit. It's powered by the Visa network, instantly issue cards to your employees. You can set limits, control spend via virtual cards. Brex offers employees instant access to online virtual credit cards with physical credit cards sent in the mail shortly thereafter. So everybody gets one. Every employee can have a corporate card with real-time limits that can be adjusted by an administrator. And embedded expense management software included with your Brex card. So you don't have to save receipts anymore. You simply reply to a text message with a picture of your receipt, and it's automatically matched to the transaction. And you get complete statement descriptions that clearly tell you what you've spent on over time. And, of course, integrations with major accounting software programs to make it all even easier on the back end. Join the thousands of startups and tech companies who use Brex to manage their growing business needs and earn valuable rewards while doing so. You can get the card free, and Twit listeners get Brex card fees waived in perpetuity at brex.com/twit. That's brex.com/twit. And we thank Brex for their support of Tech News Weekly.
Today, Bloomberg reports that the CFO of China's biggest tech company, Huawei, was arrested in Canada back on December 1st. Joining us to talk about this story is Mark Gurman, who's been following it for Bloomberg. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So tell us who was arrested and what do we know about her arrest?
So Meng Wanzhou is the chief financial officer of Huawei, obviously one of the biggest phone makers in the world. By some estimates, has eclipsed Apple as the biggest phone maker in the world, or one of the top two phone makers. And we know that she was arrested while on a layover changing flights in Canada. It's not clear exactly for what. We do have some indications as to what, but not 100%. There hasn't been a definitive announcement as to why. And we know that right now she's in the process of potentially being extradited from Canada to the U.S.
And I think what's also interesting about this has happened, like you said, on the 1st. Ms. Wanzhou requested that the details of her detainment be held from the press. Why that? That kind of confused me. I don't know. Understand why you do that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think her fear is what we see investors fearing right now, that she's going to become a trade chip between the U.S. and China, given their current arguments over tariffs right now.
So the other big thing that Huawei does is they make cell phone towers. Like, they're behind the cell phone towers. Like, how does that fit into this story?
Yeah, that comes down to one of the theories as to why she was arrested. So a little bit of background here. Back in April, the U.S. Department of Justice actually started probing Huawei for potentially violating sanctions by selling some of its equipment to Iran, right? And that equipment, as you said, is what they make. They make 5G towers. They make devices for connecting the phones to the networks. So, yes, their telecommunications equipment is right smack in the middle of this problem.
And what kind of effect could this have on the U.S.-China relations, which I feel like is an open question, but Huawei, or China rather, is saying, considering this a human rights violation, and Huawei just as a company, one of, if not the premier kind of Chinese tech company that exists. So obviously China places huge importance on this company. This is a really big deal for relations between the two countries.
Yeah, this is not good. This is going to worsen relations for sure, especially on the Chinese side. They are not going to be happy about this. And to your point, Huawei, in many ways, is like the Apple of China. Imagine the news headlines if the CFO of Apple traveled to China and was detained.
Yeah.
Right? That's what we're looking at here from their perspective.
For sure.
And so do we know when we're going to find out more information? Is it just like, are we going to find out more in the coming weeks, or do you think this is going to be a mystery?
I think by early next week, actually, we'll have a resolution, which I know is very surprising given government matters and those things take forever. But I believe there is a court proceeding or some sort of hearing tomorrow, either in the U.S. or Canada, which will give us a better picture of what's happening and how long it'll take.
I also saw the news earlier today that Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says that there's no political motivation for the arrest. And that, I guess a few things about the story kind of confused me, but that confused me as well, because it seems like it's very politically motivated. What do you think he means by that?
I think what he means is, from Canada's perspective, they have nothing to do with it. They were just brought into this because she happens to be in Canada, and Canada is one of the partners where if the U.S. is like, hey, I need you to extradite, or we need you to extradite someone, they're gonna do that, given that works vice versa as well.
So he's just basically saying, look, don't look at us. We're not part of this.
That's exactly what it is.
Look the other way.
So, I mean, is this a surprise? Because, I mean, we've been hearing, you guys reported that they were going to be harsh consequences if Huawei kept breaking these sanctions. Like, so were people surprised by this?
Oh, this was shocking. When we saw this coming through the newsroom, we were very surprised. I jumped on it immediately, and we've been following this across several teams. This is a really big deal. I mean, you see the impact on the stock market right now has been significant, not only in the U.S. or in Asia specifically, but on futures and all sorts of different stock markets globally. So this has big implications. The fact that the U.S. could ask for the extradition of a technology executive from a competitor in China is massive on its own. Its implications for the trade war are significant. So this just touches so many different things globally.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just fascinating what's happened in China since they opened up the internet, because it's just, I mean, everyone thought, well, this is going to open up democracy in China, and it just hasn't happened. And so far, it just shows that the government is going to keep doing what they want to do. But I guess we'll see. This is interesting. Thank you so much, Mark. Thanks for taking the time. I know you're a busy man. Mark has stories about this. He has stories about the future of 5G. He has an interesting piece on the iPhone XR and so much more at Bloomberg.com. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Tech that scans our eyeballs to find out if we're lying. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, an original podcast for geeks by geeks from Red Hat. That's a company that's been bringing open source technologies to the enterprise for 25 years. Command Line Heroes are the developers, the programmers, the hackers, the geeks, and the open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape. The Command Line Heroes podcast is hosted by Saran Yitbarek, a developer who founded Code Newbie and lives and breathes open source software. If you want to check her out on YouTube, she gives some really great talks. There's tons of video up there. But also check out the podcast, because in season two, it's all about living on the command line and tracking the changes that shape the world, from open source development, from programming languages to learning about supercomputers, hybrid clouds, and so, so much more. On the latest episode, they explore what serverless really means, what developers can accomplish when someone else handles the servers. Andrea Passwater shares how convenient it is to be abstract away or remove from view the infrastructure components of development. Roderick Rabba explains that going serverless can mean giving up control of your deployment and restricts your ability to respond to problems, which is why he helped create Apache OpenWhisk, an open source serverless environment framework. And Himanshu Pant considers when to use serverless services. So if you're interested in serverless, you will love this podcast. Visit redhat.com/heroes to check it out today. Subscribe to Command Line Heroes wherever you get your podcasts. Visit redhat.com/heroes for extras. And to learn more, that's redhat.com/heroes. And we thank Command Line Heroes from Red Hat for their support of this show.
So how do you know when someone is telling the truth? Polygraph tests have long been the tool of truth, but they've also been known to be inaccurate, and that has held them back over time. A company called Converis has what it believes to be a solution to the unreliable polygraph, and it involves taking a close look at the human eye. And joining us to talk about Eye Detect is Mark Harris. He's a freelance journalist who wrote about this technology from Wired. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Jason. Happy to be with you.
It's so great to get you on. Thank you for joining us today. So before we dive into Eye Detect specifically, what would you say has proven to be so incredibly unreliable over time with polygraph tests, which I feel like are like the TV and film, you know, quintessential go-to when trying to prove someone's telling the truth or lying?
Well, where to start, really? I mean, they've got so many problems. Basically, it's well understood. It's pretty well acknowledged by psychologists that when you lie, it requires a little bit more effort on your part, a little bit of cognitive work. And then you can also get excited or nervous, right? You could get sweaty. Perhaps you might start to shake. Who knows? You know, there are many physical signs. Now, what polygraph says is that definitely indicates a lie, and that definitely doesn't, right? They have these interpreters, the polygraph examiners that take the polygraph, that administer the polygraph, and those examiners believe that they can determine truth from falsehood. Well, it's been shown many times, you know, actually through a famous National Academy of Sciences report about 15 years ago that really recommended against their use for any kind of screening situation when you're trying to determine whether somebody, you know, is suitable for a job, or perhaps is you want to screen them for, an unknown crime like terrorism or some sort of rare crime like that. So they're pretty well acknowledged to have a lot of problems in the way they're administered.
But yet they continue to be used, at least to some degree. And then, of course, you wrote and spilled out more detail about something called Eye Detect technology. Mm. How does this supposedly improve on the results that you get from a polygraph?
Well, the idea behind it is that instead of getting a human behind the machine, previous stories that I've done for Wired have shown that actually a lot of the bias and problems comes with the human administrator. Well, the Converis situation, the Eye Detect system, says, let's take the human out of the loop. Let's make it all algorithmic, right? Let's feed your eyes, and they really just focus in on your eyes, the motion of your where you're looking, how quickly you blink, your pupil dilation. Let's focus on the eyes and see if we can't determine truth from falsehood. And Convera says its iDetect system detects that with an 86% accuracy rate, which is, you know, quite a lot more than polygraphs, which, you know, scientists put anywhere between about 55 and 65%. So, you know, on paper, it sounds like a great system. It takes the human out of it. And because there's no human in the loop, it's just you sitting in front of a webcam, basically, answering questions on a screen. It's much cheaper and quicker too. And that's obviously attractive to, you know, to anybody who currently uses the polygraphs. And that includes most of the police departments in the US who use it for screening out potential employees.
So I think you can start with the sentence, you take the human out of the loop and then there's trouble, especially when you're talking about bias. Like, we've heard that before, like, biases don't really exist because it's a machine. And this, like so many other technology that we say, like, there's no bias because it's a machine. This also has bias. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You're right, Megan. Exactly. I mean, for a start, just by putting a computer in front of you rather than a person, you haven't actually removed the bias. The bias can be inherent in the algorithms. Perhaps the system trained only on a certain population, right? Perhaps only men, perhaps only white people. And how does that apply to other people? You know, we just don't know. Nobody really knows. And in fact, nobody's done any scientific research on this iDetect system apart from, you know, Convera's and iDetect and the scientists who developed it. So, you know, for a start, we don't even know how that works. And then secondarily, you know, any system that involves, you know, human beings is open to bias, right? And so in my research for the story, I found that when the examiners didn't like the answers that iDetect was giving them, they put their fingers on the scale. They changed the results. For instance, when an applicant to a police department was a previous police officer but failed the test, they tweaked the results so that the police officer would pass, right? Because they said, oh, it's probably nothing. You know, we find that police officers have a less layer of guilt, will change the sensitivity. And on the other side of it, when an applicant was someone from an inner city, a place that had previously had some problems with, you know, violence and gangs, they passed a polygraph, they passed the iDetect test, you know, and guess what? The examiner said, oh, I think they might be to do with gangs. Can we change the results? And sure enough, they dialed down the algorithm and the applicant failed. So, you know, we're kind of left with the worst of both worlds. It's a system that can scale up really quickly and cheaply, and yet it still has many, if not all, of the problems that polygraph suffers from.
Wow. it's crazy hearing you describe how so easily these results are just kind of adjusted on the fly. That's pretty weird.
Humans are fallible?
that never happens. We're perfect. So you were actually subjected to the test in research for this story. Did it work? Were you nervous? What was your experience like?
Well, you know, I thought I'd put myself through it, and Convera's offered to put me through the test. So I went to one of the these testing places, and this is a testing place that tests real applicants for police jobs. And the test was really low stress. It was basically felt like I am right now, looking into a web camera at a computer. It asked me to guess to think of a number between 1 and 10, and then it would guess which one I'd thought of by asking me various questions about the numbers. And it was all very stressful, stress-free and easy. You know, I tried to hide my emotions. You know, and actually the first time I took the test, it got the number wrong because we had a miscommunication about what constitutes a number between 1 and 10, if you could believe it. I thought it included the numbers from 1 to 10, but apparently they only wanted me to choose 2 to 9. So it both missed my number, but it also missed the fact that I was thinking outside the box, that I wasn't in its range.
Yeah.
The second time I did the test, it actually got the number right. And I have to say that was a little unsettling, right? It was a little bit, you know, it felt like I'd been tricked.
Mm. Wow.
So you write that the assumption is that deception is cognitively more demanding than telling the truth. Now, is that true for everyone? I mean, that's what I've always thought, like that liars can just lie. Like I can barely tell the truth. You might think I'm lying. Like sometimes if I'm nervous, like I'm nervous, I'm a nervous person. But is it cognitively more difficult for everyone to tell the truth?
No one knows. And no one really knows what constitutes, you know, those sort of emotional arousal, they call it arousal, which sounds, you know, sort of erotic, but it actually just means like, you know, it being excited or nervous. Right. And so a big part of Convera's thing was they're saying the test is only really accurate if people are feeling arousal, if they're feeling in jeopardy, right? If they're feeling that these answers, you know, matter to them. But, you know, I think you could easily argue that if you had nothing to fear, you might go into it quite blasé and say, I've got nothing to fear, I don't feel any jeopardy. And then you might fail the test. And then vice versa, you might be super nervous to all the questions. And, you know, we just really don't know that there haven't been enough tests. And the tests, even that Converis did, some of those came with quite worrying results. There was a test done by the National Security Agency, which obviously is interested in these kinds of technologies. And they tested it on their employees, asking them whether they'd committed a real but a minor security violation, taking a cell phone into an area they weren't allowed to take it into. You know, not actually taking pictures of anything, but just having a phone on their person. And when they, you know, did that test, they found that, you know, the system was only 50% accurate. It was as good as flipping a coin to tell whether somebody had committed that problem or not. Now, they say they've got better than that since then, but who knows?
Yeah, and I guess what I keep trying to figure out is, and I guess this would be the eternal question for any sort of system that's supposed to tell whether someone's telling the truth or a lie, is what the biological give actually is, if there is one. If there is an obvious biological give that we make as humans when we are lying, what is that? And does it involve the eye? I mean, that makes sense to me as someone who knows nothing about this stuff, but is there actual science there? And I guess that's the challenge here, because this is not an open source project. It's a closed source nature of iDetect compared to kind of Polygraph, which over time we know how reliable or unreliable it is at this point, but there's years and years and years worth of use. So we've kind of adapted to that to some degree. Would you agree?
Yeah, that's right. And it's even the case that I'm not even sure that Converis, the company that developed the technology, knows it, right? When you develop an algorithm and you use machine learning to help you, you know, sort the truth from the false, you know, you don't even really know the mechanisms of what it's looking at. You give it some input data, and that input data is a really good webcam looking at somebody's eye. And then the algorithm crunches through it, you know, relying on your labels of who is guilty and who is innocent to determine the algorithm. So you're right. There's it's not like we're learning much about science by having this product. It's the way it works is a bit murky, and the way it's actually used in practice is kind of equally so.
I'm reading this book by Meredith Broussard called Artificial Unintelligence, and she works for the MIT Media Lab, and she talks about techno-chauvinism, which is just the idea that people automatically think if it's technical, if you say AI, it's going to be better. It is better. So, like, you know, and I just think this makes me think of that, because it's like, oh, it uses machine learning, so then it's going to be better. And coupled with the fact that, as you say, like, it's cheaper, and police, you know, they want to save money. So this is... Polygraphs are banned in courts, but this system is now going to go through the legal process to see if it can go into courts. I mean, do you think it's going to get through this process?
That's a tough question, right? I hope not, because I worry that it will be, right? If you get perhaps a judge who has less expertise in this and they're blinded by the science as well, then it becomes, you know, it could become a worrying trend. It already has had some, it's already been accepted in one court case, in one jurisdiction, I believe in New Mexico. And so the question is, you know, is this going to spread, or will it get snipped in the bud? Like Polygraph was very early in its, you know, very early in its development and never really recovered from that, luckily. You know, that there are, it's, you know, we all want to know the truth, right? We all want to know whether people are lying or not. And so we have these really good systems, or we have some really well-established systems, open source systems like, you know, the courts and judiciaries, and, you know, evidence-based decision-making. And, you know, handing over the decisions to these products, you know, can't really do anything. You know, it can't really be a good thing, right? I think we all have a certain amount of right of privacy within our own head as well about what we think about things. And that we should be judging our behaviors and actions and the evidence rather than, you know, these devices that claim to be able to peer inside our skull.
Especially when you're considering, like, yes, they may say that iDetect's success rate, or let's say failure rate, is lower than that of of a polygraph. But still, like, if it's not like close to 100%, if it's not like 99.8% or whatever, you're still talking about a lot of false positives over the grand scheme of things over time. And that's not good enough when that could result in someone being incarcerated when they are not guilty or whatever the case may be. We've got a long way to go.
Yeah. I mean, and this isn't even really theoretical. You know, Converis tells me that there is a Middle Eastern country that is intending to use this to screen arriving passengers at customs for terrorism. Now, terrorism is an incredibly small crime. It's a very, very rare crime. You know, perhaps one in 10,000, one in 100,000, one in a million. And if you have a product that's even, 90% accurate, which Converis doesn't even claim, then you really get most of the signals you get are going to be, the system is going to say that 10% of the people are terrorists, right? Even if only a fraction of 1% of those people are terrorists, right? And how do you solve that? I mean, that's a really super worrying, reliance on that when you could actually be putting your resources in far more proven technologies and proven methods of, preventing terrorism or detecting any sort of crime.
Yeah, no kidding.
So I guess we'll never know. I mean, when my kids were littler, I could always tell they were lying, and now they're teenagers, and it's anybody's guess. So if only I could have bottled that up when they were younger and then put that data into an AI, then...
Who knows? Maybe iDetect will soon be an app on your iPhone.
Yes.
Like, look into this, kid. Are you lying?
Yes.
Miniaturized.
I mean, it could be.
It totally
could. That's the scary thing.
Yeah.
That's scary.
Really good point. Mark Harris, pleasure talking with you. Really appreciate you hopping on to tell us about this story. I know you write for a number of different places. You're an independent journalist. Where do you want people to follow you online?
You can have a look at my Twitter, at M.E. Harris, or just keep an eye out. Please send me tips. I'm always interested in finding out about new technologies that may have a questionable angle to them, particularly when where they meet society as well.
Absolutely. Mark Harris, thank you again. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. All right, turning marbles into computers. That's what we're going to talk about next. But first, let's take a break and thank the sponsor. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Eero. The single router model doesn't work for our increasingly high bandwidth world. It's simple physics. Like light waves, Wi-Fi waves don't go through walls well. Imagine asking a light bulb in your living room to light your master bedroom. It's not going to happen. What you need is a distributed system. And this is what offices have had for years, but at considerable work and even more so expense. With Eero, you can install an enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system in your home in just a few minutes. It's super easy to do. You simply download the Eero app on your iOS or Android device, and it's going to walk you through each step of the process. It's a quick process, easy, painless. The Eero app lets you manage your network from the palm of your hand, so you're going to know how many devices are connected at any given point, as well as the internet speed that you're getting from your service provider. You can also easily create and share a guest network when people come over. Instead of giving them your master password, give them the guest credentials. Eero is protected with state-of-the-art WPA2 encryption. And because it controls the hardware and the software for your entire network, it ensures that you're always secure. Traditional routers don't push software updates to their customers. That, of course, as we've talked about on the show even, leave them vulnerable to cyber attacks. Eero updates automatically so that you not only have the latest features, but the latest security at all times. It's updated automatically for you. Eero has incredible customer support as well. You can call and get a Wi-Fi expert within 30 seconds. And now Eero is offering Eero Plus. It's a simple designed, reliable security that defends all your home's devices against a growing number of threats such as malware, spyware, phishing attacks, as well as unsuitable content. The combination of Eero with Eero Plus provides complete protection for your network, your devices, and those who use them as they connect to the internet. Eero Plus offers the ability to block malicious and unwanted content across your entire network. By checking the sites that you visit against a database of millions of known threats, Eero Plus prevents you from accidentally visiting malicious sites without slowing anything down. Aero Plus automatically tags sites that contain violent, illegal, or adult content, so you can choose what your kids can and cannot visit right in the Aero app. I've got Aero in our home. We've got a few different stations throughout the home. We don't even have to think about our internet, our Wi-Fi connection anymore. It always just works, and that's the beauty, as well as the simple setup. It was just a breeze to set up, and you should check it out for yourself. Never think about Wi-Fi again. Get $100 off the Aero base unit, 2 beacons package, and 1 year of Aero Plus. If you visit Aero.com/twit, you're going to get all that, and make sure and enter the code TWIT at checkout. That's Aero.com/twit, and at checkout, enter TWIT, and we thank Aero for their support.
On Tuesday, I hosted Mac Break Weekly while Leo was gone, and I talked about how my kids had bought themselves this sort of Tesla coil type thing on Amazon, and how I was really afraid that they were going to burn the entire house down.
That sounds safe.
Yeah, it's not safe. So Steve Gibson, host of Security Now, always concerned with my safety, he emailed me immediately recommending a more innovative and much safer STEM gift for the holidays. It's called the Turing Tumble. And after watching the video of the creator explaining why he created it, I immediately ordered one and then emailed him to come talk to us about it on the show. Welcome, Paul Boswell, professor at the University of Minnesota and creator of the Turing Tumble. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
Hey, Paul.
So first
of all, sounds really cool, by the way.
it is cool. Like, I wish they had made it. Like, since then, people have also sent me like instructions on how their own kids have made a Tesla coil. So that's the next step. Actually, the next step is waiting for this to get here. And I don't even know if it got shipped last night. So I don't even know if I'm going to be able to wait for Christmas to give it to them. Tell everybody what it is, the Turing Tumble.
Yeah, so it's actually a mechanical computer powered by marbles, and it's a game. So you have a series of puzzles, and each puzzle has something that you have to make a machine to complete. So at first, it's really simple. You try to put parts on the board to make, you know, a pattern of balls at the bottom. So like red, blue, red, blue, red, blue. But as it goes, it gets more and more challenging. And pretty soon you're learning binary and you're making a counter. And then you learn how to do addition and subtraction. It literally is a mechanical computer, a marble-powered computer. If it was big enough, it could do anything a regular computer can do. But even at this size, it can do an awful lot of stuff. So as you work through the puzzles, you learn how computers work at their most basic level. You learn how switches connected together in clever ways can do really cool stuff, really smart things.
And so talk a little bit about why you created this toy. I know you have kids, and what made you decide to make something like this?
Yeah, well, you know, we have computers everywhere around us now. They're you know, in our pockets. They're even in our microwaves and dishwashers and everywhere. But there's very little that teaches how computers work. And I really like the new push into teaching kids coding, but I think it would be great if we could also teach them how computers work. So I started working on this a few years ago, just kind of on the side. And I made it, I prototyped it, and then I brought it to work one day, and everybody's like, this is so cool, you got to do something with this. So my wife and I put together a Kickstarter, and we were hoping to raise like $48,000 to pay for injection molds, and ended up raising $400,000. And so since then, we manufactured it, and it's been great.
I love this. And you're talking about, you know, all these products right now that are really getting kids familiar with the ideas of coding. A toy that I've been testing out is the Kano Harry Potter wand coding kit. And, you know, I have an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old daughter, 2 daughters, and and they love it. And I don't think that they understand, and I imagine it would be the same with this, is that to them it's a toy that allows them to do really neat things, but it's the concepts that they're learning in the process, even if they might be a little impatient throughout the process, because sometimes they're like, I just wanted to do the thing I wanted to do. It's like, well, you got to go through the steps first in order to get there. So how do you successfully bridge children from the concepts that they're learning using this into applying that to something broader, you know, computer science as a whole?
Yeah. So one of the things I like is that coding toys teach sequencing. You put commands in a certain order, and you can run them, and then you can see, did it work or not, right? And I think that troubleshooting is really important. You have a problem, and how do you go about debugging that problem? And that's, you know, the same with Turing Tumble is you put the parts on the board in a certain way, you start the machine running, and if it's not set up correctly, it won't produce the right output. So then you have to figure out, well, where did I go wrong? And you have to figure out strategies. And you also have to figure out not just sequencing, but sort of a big part of programming is coming up with the algorithms and the ideas of how you're going to write code to solve a problem. And that is really what Turing Tumble focuses on a lot. A puzzle will say, make a machine that can detect if the right number is less than the left number. And you have to think, well, geez, how can that do that? It's marbles and plastic parts, right? But, you know, you think about it a while and you think, well, maybe if I did this, I could get it to work. And you try it and it gets really close. And then you fix a couple problems and you're there.
So what age would you recommend this for? I mean, I know a lot of, in the video, the kids are a little bit younger than mine. I have 13-year-olds and a 15-year-old, but you said that, you know, that, and it looked interesting to me as an adult. So what age would you recommend this for?
Yeah. So we, I think 8 and up works the best. We've taught some classes, at our kids' elementary school with it, and ages, third grade and up is great. That works perfectly. And it's so I'd say third grade and up is pretty good. They already know how to read, and they it just works well. And then certainly there's no age limit. It's kind of interesting. We found that kids and adults, there's not a whole lot of difference in how fast they can go through the puzzles. They start easy enough, certainly, that an 8-year-old can get quite a ways through. But by the end, they get challenging, even for us, you know, professional software developer, they get pretty tough.
That is so cool. And then how much time would you say, and I realize this probably varies sharply between players, but to understand the pieces well enough to be able to create their own things, like it's one thing to kind of like tackle the puzzles and be like, hey, I solved that. It's another thing to have an idea and be like, I know how all of these components operate so that I can have this be the outcome.
Yeah, that's a good question. So it starts off just teaching one part. So it starts off with teaching how to use this little green part here. And so you do a series of 5 puzzles. And after you kind of get the hang of this part, it unlocks another part. And this one's called the crossover. Once you do another 5 puzzles with this, it unlocks another part. And as you go, you build up sort of these tricks. And every puzzle, you kind of learn a new trick or a new concept. And I guess by the end, you've built up quite a few ideas and how to build things, and then you can make your own stuff.
I love it.
It's sort of like learning. I mean, it is that is the process of learning to code. If you went to a boot camp or something, you know, it's like just the basic hello world and moving on from there.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
And so how did I wonder how the manga came in. I mean, that's brilliant. Like, it's another thing that kids love. Like, right. did you hire an artist to do that? How did that come into play?
So I used to be a professor at the University of Minnesota, and I had a research group there. And one of my students was in my office, and she was showing me some work she did, and her desktop wallpaper had some artwork on it. And I said, oh, that's cool. Where did you get that? And she said, oh, I drew it. I was like, wow, that's really good. And so I was starting to work on this, and I said, you know, I'd really like a story to go with this. I think it'd be great if you kind of unlock more of the story as you work through the puzzles. And she was like, yeah, that'd be great. She does a lot of artwork, but she'd never published anything before. And so this was a new experience for her, and she nailed it. She did a great job.
What an amazing opportunity for her too. Like, you know, now she has her art as, you know, as part of the foundation of this awesome toy. I'm sure that you prototyped different ideas around this when you were thinking about it. And I don't know if it's easy to explain that, but how did this evolve? Like, from the very beginning, were you thinking that the board would be a lot smaller or a lot larger, or where did that come from?
Yeah, it kind of evolved. I knew what the general parts would need to be to make it a computer, to make it actually Turing complete. I started with 3D printing parts, and the first ones didn't work at all. And then just kept kind of making, you know, small iterations until I finally had a 3D printed version that worked. And then I knew that, you know, that wasn't going to be something that could be injection molded, because there's a surprising number of requirements for injection molding. It's not as easy as you think. So yeah. I started learning about how to do that and changing them so that they could be injection molded. And then I had the part CNC milled, which means rather than adding plastic, it actually takes a chunk of plastic and cuts it away. So when you do that, you can have it made out of the materials that it'll be in the final form, and you can get it really, really precise. And so I had the parts made, and, you know, it worked for that one copy, but just making one set by CNC milling was like, I don't know, $1,500 or something. So it certainly couldn't be done on any sort of scale.
Right.
Well, this is amazing. And you were voted the most popular STEM toy to give for the holidays this year from the Smithsonian, which
that was
just
cool.
Great. Like, they had all the age, like three to whatever, that, you know, and then you were overall the best gift. So I'm so glad this is getting the attention that you deserve. You said, you're no longer a professor. So is this your full-time work now?
Yeah. This came out of nowhere.
That is amazing. Wow, congratulations.
So do you
not see myself doing this at this point in my life. That's for sure. No.
And then is there, what's next? Do you have anything that you're working on now, or just getting this?
Yeah. So this takes a surprising amount of time, but I'm working on something else. I think something that could teach electronics in a more tangible way. I'm working on some parts for that, and I think it'll be really cool. I'm excited about it. It's going to be a little while, though, probably at least a year, but it'll be pretty neat.
Yeah, well, I noticed in the video you have, I think that your kids are playing with snap circuits, which was something my kids love.
Oh, yeah, we've got snap circuits at home. My kids love those, too.
But then it's, they easily grow out of them pretty quickly, so it's...
Yeah, they're really great. The problem is you can't see the electricity, you can't really feel it. You connect the parts together and you can tell if it works because a light turns on, but, you know, something that's a little more tangible is what I'm working on now. I think it could be cool.
Awesome. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
Paul Boswell is the creator of the Turing Tumble, which is available to order now at TuringTumble.com. And it's $69, we should say that. And there's discounts if you're going to use it, if you're an educator. You can email them and find out about discounts. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul. Best of luck.
Take care.
Appreciate your time.
Bye.
These are the weeks of panic. Panic that we forgot to buy that one last gift, and so we purchase it online and have it shipped to our doorstep. And unfortunately, thieves know this and seem to have no problem walking right up and taking those gifts for themselves. But CNET's Ben Fox Rubin wrote about the Ring Neighbors app that is in its own right kind of Neighborhood Watch 2.0, and he joins us now. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back. So first of all, just full disclosure, Ring is a sponsor on the Twit Network. The story has nothing to do with the sponsorship. But with that out of the way, Ben, it really seems like package theft, at least I feel like I'm hearing about it all the time. Maybe it's on the rise. I'm not sure. Is it just that we're more aware of it when it happens now? Or is there like the increase of online shopping? Is that making theft more pervasive? What do you think?
Yes, I would probably say that the increase in online shopping, people get so many Amazon packages delivered to their doorstep these days that a lot of crimes are crimes of opportunity. So if you have a lot of packages just sitting out on your front stoop, that's something very easy for people to just pick up and steal. Shore Packaging came out with a study last year that I thought was pretty interesting that said about 31% of people that they interviewed in a consumer survey that they did had been directly impacted by package theft. They also called it porch pirates. But obviously, this is something that will become more prevalent as people do more online shopping, not less. So certain things like the Ring app, video doorbells. Ring isn't the only one that makes those. Obviously, Nest makes them too. those are going to become more important, I guess, as people become more concerned about this issue.
Absolutely. So there is an app. It's been around for a little while, the Neighbors app by Ring. Although I've noticed in my Ring app that it has these videos kind of filtered in there, whether I have the app installed or not. But I think the reality, from what I understand from your write-up, is that the Neighbors app, you don't have to be a Ring subscriber to participate with it, right? This is truly like anybody can upload video to see what's going on. What have you seen in this app in your use?
Yeah, and you don't actually have to be a Ring user to use this feature that's also in the Ring app. But the Neighbors app, they just launched it this year, and it's very specifically targeted, as you said, kind of Neighborhood Watch 2.0, where folks in my community in the New Jersey suburbs posted various things like package theft, vandalism of an outdoor light, people that were trying to break into a car, allegedly trying to break into a car. It was definitely eye-opening for me, and it was something that I was particularly curious about because there were a group of folks that were in my neighborhood a couple of weeks ago that were just going into unlocked vehicles. So again, crimes of opportunity. There were a bunch of people in my neighborhood that just didn't lock their cars at night. That's how safe they felt like the neighborhood was. There were people that came in at around 3 in the morning. They started unlocking cars or just opening unlocked cars and going through what was in there. One of my neighbors across the street actually has a Nest video camera and sent us a video of what was going on at 3 in the morning. And that was definitely something that made me start thinking about this. And so when I was writing the story and started using the Neighbors app, certainly made me aware of the fact that, yes, these types of things can happen in any community.
Mm-hmm. I've caught nothing good on any of my cameras. I caught like a bird on my Nest cam, which was, I thought was ironic, making a little nest right by there. But okay, so I downloaded this app, here it is on my iPad, and somebody's stealing a package right there. The cat. Apparently this person stole a bunch of stuff and the cat didn't care at all. So I'm glad I have a dog.
So much for security cat.
Most of this stuff, I guess this guy has a PG&E scam. He looks official. Some guy's trying to, so this woman walked right into the house. This guy tried a door, and sometimes people just say they don't want to, you know, show the video, but, this one that I found, was, That kid just ringing a doorbell. Like, that's, I used to do that.
That's so bad.
No, that's not, but this person's reporting it as crime. So I just think, like, that was my childhood. I did that all the time. but anyway, after just looking through these, I was terrified. And I felt like I don't know that I want to keep looking through these. Like, it's the same reason why I don't watch the nightly news, because it just makes me feel like I'm living in a scarier world than I really am.
You definitely bring up a good point about a kid just ringing a doorbell and running away. I definitely saw a couple people that were just stealing whole bowls or whole baskets of Halloween candy. That happened to me. I didn't catch anybody that actually did it, but I kind of felt a little bit like, oh, geez, it wasn't just me that happened to. So I felt a little bit better about it, that the crime wave of Halloween candy theft wasn't just impacting me, but even Ring, when I talk to them, will admit that they are kind of taking a little bit of the fun of being an idiot when you're younger and doing some of these things. And hopefully people are a little bit more conscious of that they're not just trying to embarrass kids for doing silly kid stuff that really isn't harming people that much, like ringing a doorbell in the middle of the day. Do you really need to embarrass a kid for doing that? I'm sure some of the commenters in some of those cases are calling folks out for that kind of thing for sure. But it's looking at the Neighbors app, if people do get a value out of it and aren't just scared from it and don't just feel like this is a marketing stunt by Ring to try to get people to buy more video doorbells, then I would argue that this could have a significant benefit for communities in trying to prevent crimes. At least that's the most positive way of looking at it, I would say.
It's funny that you mentioned the Halloween candy, you know, bull stealer thing, because 2 years ago that happened to me. And I did have the Ring video doorbell, so I was able to look at it later and watch the video and see the two kids that decided to take all the candy.
Did you know the kids?
Was it mine?
I don't know the kids, but I saw the kids that came up and they totally were like laughing. Like one was, you know, on watch and the other one was like dumping the candy in, and then they ran away. They had no idea I was taping the whole thing. Anyways, whatever. It's just Halloween candy. I'm happy they took it because that means that my kids didn't eat it. Mm-hmm. So kind of shifting gears a little bit, Nextdoor. I feel like we've heard a lot about Nextdoor and the problems that Nextdoor has had with people using the service to kind of profile and, you know, negatively profile. Do you envision that services like the Neighbors app kind of, I mean, it seems like it's easy for it to go there, right? Maybe it's designed for people to crack down on things, but then people can get overzealous on how they select that this person is doing something bad or this is a bad person based on how they look or that sort of thing. Is there any indication that that challenge will hit the Neighbors app?
Yes, that is obviously a concern, and it's a really good question to talk about. With Nextdoor, they were obviously aware that this kind of thing was happening in their security area. So they did try to address it, where if somebody will post something in that section of Nextdoor, nowadays, if you identify somebody by their race, you're asked to provide a little bit more information. As far as, you know, what's their shoe color? What were they wearing? What's their hair color? What kind of hair did they have? That kind of thing. They claim that significantly cut down on profiling just by having people provide a little bit more information, or at least asking them, okay, you can't just, you know, specify somebody by their race or what's their skin color and, you know, make just kind of blanket that statement. Mm-hmm. As it relates to Neighbors, it's still small enough, and Ring wants to, as they claim, do it right, that every single post is reviewed by a human being before it actually goes up, by a Ring employee before it goes up. Also, Jamie Siminoff, the Ring CEO, who I've spoken to a few times, said that most of the posts aren't text. A lot of them are just videos, and he says that most of the videos will speak for themselves. Obviously, if you look at the comments, you dig into those, you can see that there's still some back and forth that does go on as it relates to that, because there's still some of them are open to interpretation. But I do think this is an important conversation to have as more people get security cameras, as more people get video doorbells. Obviously, you don't want to see profiling go on and people get wrongly accused of things just because of who they are.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, video can help, but it can also exacerbate it, I guess, as well. So I think Jen Takahashi, who does the Best of Nextdoor Twitter account, which is one of my favorite, I think she should probably do a Best of the Neighbors app, too, because I bet there's a lot of crazy stuff going on in our chat room.
There's some good. It's very entertaining. I mean, like, if you want to take a break from like Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, you name it, I was definitely entertained and was surprised when I saw the Neighbors app. And, you know, some of it I thought was legitimately useful. And I'd be curious to see how law enforcement gets involved to try to use some of this information as an additional tool for themselves as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, but there's going to be the people that adjust are like, somebody was walking by with a flashlight and, you know, just scared of everything. But let's talk about something more positive. The app was used recently in the wildfires, in the Woolsey fire. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the folks at Ring mentioned to me that there were some fires that were tearing through Southern California, and it was actually being utilized as this hyper local service to allow people to know how their homes or their neighborhoods were affected, especially if they were evacuated. So the guy that actually is the GM for the Neighbors app had to be evacuated. He was sent about an hour away from his home, and he was able to open up the Neighbors app and use it to find out what was going on around his house. And they'd seen an enormous spike of people using the Neighbors app during these emergency situations, specifically for the fire. And they said that this is a really positive aspect. This is what we want people to use the service for. We don't actually want folks to go onto it every day like they would a normal social app. But in emergency situations, in public emergency type of situations like the fire or other situations like that, they saw an enormous value in providing people with information, in having Ring provide people with information in their feeds. Also, in certain circumstances, have law enforcement or law enforcement press releases be added into that. And they claim that it's a lot less noisy than places like Facebook or Nextdoor or Twitter. But, you know, obviously you can get this type of information from other sources as well.
Yeah. Well, Ben Fox Rubin, really appreciate you taking time to talk to us about this and raising our awareness of the term porch pirates. I've never heard that before. Where do you want people to follow you online?
I'm on Twitter, mostly, at Ben Fox Rubin. And yeah, definitely find me there.
Right on. Thanks again, Ben. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Take care. All right, and that is that. 5 interviews, 1 show. It's because we love you. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. And you can be part of the show by emailing us, tnw@twit.tv. We appreciate it.
Subscribe to the show. We also appreciate that. Go to twit.tv/TNW. And if you want to tweet at me about anything, about why I shouldn't be scared about my neighborhood or anything funny you saw on your next door or in your neighbor's app, I love that stuff. I'm at Megan Maroney.
All right. And I am Jason Howell on Twitter. Send me any tweets that you send to Megan because I don't like being left out. Thanks to everyone in here who helps us with the show. Jammer V, Josh, Burke, Colleen, everybody who helps us. Alex, I think, was snooping around, giving me dirty looks every once in a while. And thanks to you for watching. We'll see you next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.